And hello everyone, this is Didactic Mind, episode 35, The God That Failed. Warm welcome to everybody listening in, very warm welcome to my readers from the blog, my SoundCloud subscribers. As always, if you have not yet subscribed, please make sure you hit the subscribe button. That way you will always be first up for another video, and you'll always get notified, or at least for as long as I'm on SoundCloud itself, because eventually I will move off it once my subscription expires. I'm not going to renew it. SoundCloud put up the stupid BLM black insignia thing, black square, where basically they said, well, Black Lives Matter, and that makes black people automatically more important than everyone else. I'm sorry, I'm not going to countenance you paying more money to an organization whose roots are lesbian, feminist, and Marxist, and certainly not one that is as openly antithetical to the interests of white people and of Western civilization in general as BLM. So yeah, they're not going to get any more money from me once my subscription expires, whenever that is. I think it's a year away. But at any rate, I wanted to talk today about an interesting topic related to good government. So humanity has tried many, many different forms of government. And if you go back to Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers, which is not really a science fiction novel, it's actually a civics lesson, the best civics lesson of your life, disguised as a sci-fi novel. And coincidentally, also happens to be the greatest military science fiction novel ever written. You'll find a lot of interesting insights and ideas about political systems in general, which ones work and which ones don't. Ultimately, the political systems that work are the ones where people have skin in the game. But even that usually isn't enough, where you have basically people who have served in the military or have served their government, have put their lives on the line for the right to vote. Well, even that is not enough, as it happens. And we have many, many examples throughout human history showing which systems kind of worked and which ones did not. So let's start by way of lesson, of course, with the systems that did not work. The systems that did not work always come down, or are always evidenced in the debate between Plato and Aristotle. And in fact, every debate about politics, no matter what the subject, no matter where the individual participants stand in terms of their personal beliefs, always comes down to Plato versus Aristotle. That's it. And if you want to reduce it down even further than that, it always comes down to God versus Lucifer. That's it. But that's a, you know, at a fundamental level, it's God versus Lucifer. For the rest of us, what does it mean, you know, Plato versus Aristotle? Well, Plato wrote a book called The Republic, in which he basically said that the wisest and most accomplished of men should rule over everyone else, and that society should be organized in forms that obey the commands of these wise men, these incredibly enlightened rulers, who will tell everyone else how to think and what to do and how to live. In Heinlein's book, this is considered to be ant-like communism and weird in the extreme. Whereas Aristotle's point of view on the freedoms of man was equally clear. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, that men are not angels, effectively. I mean, he didn't say that, but the content of his work essentially said men need government to restrain their worst impulses, and that government is always going to have a bent towards tyranny. That's a fact. I mean, the kinds of men who seek out power are usually the kinds of men who shouldn't have it in the first place, because they themselves are not well suited to wielding it. So when men seek out power, the others around them should seek to restrain that power as much as possible, and therefore power should be dispersed away from any centralization to the maximum extent possible. Now, if you look throughout human history, that's where politics has always gone. It's always gone to either extreme centralization or extreme decentralization. And there's always this perpetual tug of war between the two systems. From that tug of war has resulted every single strain of political thought, ideology, and government organization that we've ever had. The extreme centralizers are responsible for the worst systems of government ever invented, such as pure communism, which sounds like it's purely decentralized, but it's actually not. If you look at the Communist Manifesto, it's not about individual people having a voice, it's about the state owning everything. The state is not the people. The state is the government, owns everything. And if you want the clearest possible example of what that's like in a modern context, you have to look probably at modern China, which is ruled over by the Chinese Communist Party. That is the purest exemplar we have today of a top-down statist bureaucracy in which the government controls basically everything. On the other hand, you have the maximum decentralized model, where regional governments and local governments are responsible to the greatest extent possible for the happiness and well-being of their citizens, and power is deliberately diluted away from the center and out towards the localities. Now, the USA used to be such a power. If you want a more sensible, less stupid, less badly realized, less shaky version of this, you can look to Switzerland. And there's an old joke, which I've told on these podcasts before. God created two republics on this earth, the United States of America and Switzerland. He created Switzerland to show the world how it could be done, and the USA as a warning to everyone else. And that's about right, in all honesty. That's about correct. Everything else more or less falls somewhere in between, outright single-party, single-person rule, and complete devolution down to the individual. The extremes are never going to be fully realized because of the innate, you know, fragility of human beings. We can't really stick to either system 100% of the time. The single-party lockstep rule envisioned by some of the greatest dystopian writers of the 20th century, such as Aldous Huxley or George Orwell or Zamyatin. If you want a really great dystopian novel, go read Zamyatin's We. That's all it is. That's all it's called, We. In Russian, I think it's just called Nas, or something like that. And the novel depicts a true communist society ruled over by completely mechanistic principles. There's also a great book by Henry Hazlitt called Time Will Run Back, in which the breaking away from that kind of pure top-down society is envisioned. If you go by what Huxley said, society is separated out into various castes based on genetics. If you go by what Orwell said, the party controls everything. The party is all. And the party will invent enemies to destroy, to keep the public riled up and in a state of perpetual war fever. And if you go by Zamyatin's approach, it's completely mathematically lockstep. Everything's in perfect order, and everything is determined by the central government. You know, so that's one extreme. Henry Hazlitt's book, if you haven't read it, is well worth reading. It's a great book. It basically explores the question of what if we had to invent capitalism? What if we lived in a world where capitalism didn't exist? Hazlitt's argument is that we will find a way to break out of those chains, and we will find a way to invent a free enterprise system, and we will show that that free enterprise system works better than the alternatives. And he demonstrates this really well throughout the book. He shows exactly how people could create a free market economy from the ruins of a socialist top-down economy. Great book, well worth reading. On the other end of the scale, you have the complete, anarcho-capitalist, minarchist, libertarian dream of zero central government whatsoever. Everyone is sovereign over himself. Everyone has the right to defend himself, and voluntary, spontaneous, random voluntary associations will spring out of individual gatherings of people. No one will ever be beholden to a state or a religion of any kind. There will be complete freedom of movement, and there will always be total sort of individual responsibility for everything. Both of these are extremes, idealistic utopian extremes, which will never ever be realized because both of them fundamentally ignore the realities of man. In between these two extremes, humanity has always tried to come up with a workable system of government. Some of these work, most of these don't. The ones that don't work are typically the ones that either are based on a flawed understanding of human nature or simply refuse to keep up with the times. So, as you've probably heard me reference in previous podcasts and domain queries, there throughout human history, the caste system has been tried in various countries in various iterations. In some, it's been considered a religious approach to life. The caste system exists within the religion. In other places, it is just a function of economic reality. And in others still, it's just something that kind of sort of evolves out of daily life. There's no getting around that fact. So if you look at India, which is the exemplar of the caste system, I mean, that's been around for what, 2,000 years, roughly speaking? The caste system was codified by Hindu scholars through the Vedas and the scriptures, whatever, in Sanskrit, the writings and teachings that people have come up with through the many thousands of years of Hinduism's existence, and is justified by divine writ, basically. So the caste system in Indian society is learned people on top, then the Brahmins on top, next being the educated classes and the people who have the most education, the most talent, the most knowledge. Like most Asian societies, Chinese society in general, Indian society is heavily based around book learning. And the people who get the most respect were and still are the people with the most knowledge. That is true even unto this day. So the next caste down is the Kshatriyas, as I mentioned, the warrior caste, the people who do all the fighting and the ruling, the actual administration of day-to-day work. The kings, the princes, the warriors, and the government bureaucrats generally tend to be of this caste, or tended to be of this caste. The next group down would be the Vaishyas, the merchants, people who are in charge of the vulgar business of selling things, and basically the shopkeepers, It was considered a relatively honorable profession, but not enough to really impress anybody. And the lowest, the sort of base of that pyramid, which was quite wide, would be the Shudras, the manual laborers, people who get charged with building things, carpentry, farming, various other manual jobs which nobody wants to get their hands dirty. You'll notice, by the way, that there's a significant downward progression from people who never get their hands dirty to people who always get their hands dirty. And you'll also notice, I mean, if you're a close observer of such things, you'll also notice that the Hindu caste system does operate on the basis of skin color. It is not coincidental that Brahmins were the lightest skinned and Shudras were the darker skinned in this structure. And then, on top of that, you had the untouchables, the Dalits, and others, who were genuinely, I mean, they were literally called untouchable, because if you touched one, you would have to, I mean, you know, depending on which bit of Hindu scripture you followed, you would have to run off and drink a cocktail of cow's milk, urine, and dung, and hair. And I'm not making that up, that's actually what one of the recommendations of Sanskrit scripture. You know, you start off your day by drinking sort of whey, like curd, milk, hair, dung, and piss altogether. I wish I was making this up. I'm not. Depending on which, you know, caste you were or which subcaste you were, you couldn't go and even associate with somebody. And as you will note from, if you read Richard Grenier's article, which I've referenced a couple of times on the blog, it is possible for someone in one of the lower castes to infect somebody else from one of the higher castes with bad karma or something from a range of up to like 64 feet, which is, you know, more than the length of a tennis court, I think. It is ridiculous. It is absurd, but, you know, that's what they chose to live with, and that's how they governed and organized their society. That was their caste system. If you turn to China and Japan, they also had a feudal system for thousands of years, and it worked for them, because in a feudal society, land is everything. The people who own the land are the people who have the power. It's that simple. Most societies throughout history have been feudal at some point or another. The exceptions have been places like Greek city-states, where, you know, the system of government was organized very differently because the needs of the populations were very different. But most of settled lands throughout history have operated on a feudal system of some kind. And it does sort of work. The problem is it leads to stagnation and economic decay, because basically in a caste system, everybody's locked into a particular role in society. And eventually that leads to monopolies, it leads to technological stagnation, and it leads to deadlock, societal deadlock. So eventually, whenever something better comes along, whenever a more technologically advanced society comes along, that system always breaks down. So that system existed in China as well. It existed in Japan, and in Japan for about 400 years before Westerners came along and broke open Japan, forcibly broke open Japan. The caste system had existed for all of that time and was very deeply entrenched in Japanese culture. It took a tremendous, you know, monumental shock to upend it. It took a revolution, basically. It took the end of the shogunate to create a new system where you had a parliamentary monarchy, basically, even though the emperor at the time was predominant. And that leads to another system of government, which we have been shown works, and that is the divine right of kings. This, too, has existed in pretty much every society in history. Kings and tyrants have come to power and have justified that power by saying, my rule is the will of the gods or of God himself. And it doesn't matter where you look. It doesn't matter whether you look at Christian kingdoms or Islamic kingdoms or Jewish kingdoms or Chinese kingdoms or African kingdoms or anywhere else. Every single society where you look at the rule of God kings, it's always the same story, every single time. The ruler is justified in his approach. by taking power from the heavens. The only societies where this has generally worked are societies where the king is seen to be doing the will of the gods. And the major flaw with this approach is that if you put a man in charge of everything, you have a man in charge of everything. A man is fallible, a man is flawed, a man is prone to fits of hubris and foolishness. A man is capable of making terrible decisions that will condemn his fellows. Now, if you look at the Bible, and you look at 1st and 2nd Kings, which chronicle all of this stuff, you know, all of the kings of Israel and Judea, what you will see is that very, 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 very few kings, I think there's like maybe 6 kings, I could be wrong about this, you know, I'm not a biblical scholar, I'm not an expert, so you know, if I get the number wrong, somebody come along and slap me down. If I get the number wrong, somebody tell me. But I think it's like 6 kings in all of the entire line since King David and King Solomon that were truly faithful to the will of the Lord. The kings who were not faithful to the will of the Lord saw their punishments ranging from mild to extremely severe, because some of them were good kings and maintained the will of God for the most part, but were stupid enough to exercise or to avoid exercising the fullness of God's law in all things. A great example of this would be King Solomon himself. Or if you go, you know, one generation back, King David. King David was the chosen one of God. I mean, he was the man chosen by God. And if you look at the story in 1st and 2nd Samuel of King David's rise to power, what do you see? Well, you see that Saul, you basically see the people of Israel crying out for a king. And they say to the Lord, or they say to the prophets, we want a king because a king will make us a great and worthy people, and we will have a king just like everybody else around us. Everyone else has kings. We want a king too, because we want to be just like everyone else. And God says to them, don't be stupid. I picked you people for a specific reason, because you're not like everybody else. You're the lowest of the low. I picked you because you would show the world by coming up from this incredibly low position that you were in as slaves, as downtrodden, beaten people, to bring forth my law and demonstrate to the world the validity and majesty of God's law. I realize I am massively paraphrasing here, so you know, if I get something wrong in the scriptures, somebody tell me. But the people of Israel say to the Lord, yeah, you know, we want to be a great and worthy people. We don't want to be ruled over by judges anymore. We want to have a king. So God says, all right, fine. You do realize that if you have a king, he's going to inflict unjust taxes on you and be arbitrary in his application of the law, and he's going to lead you to war, and he's going to corrupt your daughters and kill your sons, and he's going to be like a plague upon you. And the people of Israel say, yep, we get that, we accept it, that's on us, you know, we just want a king because we're willing to trade all of that bad stuff for the greatness that a king will give us. And God kind of rolls his eyes and says, all right, you asked for it, you know, I can't deal with you people, you're too stupid. Maybe you just need to be taught through example. So he turns over to the application of his law to mortal men. And what happens? Well, the people go out and pick Saul. And he is consecrated with the horn of clay. Which is to say, if you look at the types and shadows in the Bible, the horn of clay is a direct reference to the fact that the first man, the first man with a soul, I should say, Adam, the first soul, was brought forth out of clay, out of dirt and dust, by the Lord. So, effectively, Saul is the choice of humans, not God. And this is very important because, as you see throughout the stories of the Bible, Saul makes bad decision after bad decision after bad decision, and he is riven with the insecurities and jealousies and problems that are inherent in men. Now, David eventually comes along, and David is son of Jesse. Now, David is a kind of a layabout. I mean, Jesse is approached by, I think, Samuel, and Jesse brings out all of his sons, and Samuel says, no, this isn't, these aren't, you know, and they're all strong, healthy boys. They're all tough, big-built, you know, burly men who've been working in the fields all their lives, and they are strong and capable warriors who would be good in a fight, etc., etc. And Samuel goes along and looks at all of them, and he says, these aren't the people, this isn't the guy I'm looking for. Don't you have another son? Don't you have anyone else? And Jesse says, yeah, I've got David, he's my youngest, but he's a complete wastrel. I mean, he sits around dreaming all day, and he's completely worthless in the fields, he hardly pulls his weight, he doesn't do any work. He's a scrawny little kid, what can you possibly want with him? So Samuel says to him, yeah, okay, fine, just bring him along. Let me take a look at him. So David comes out, and he's got, you know, I mean, again, I'm filling in a lot of gaps here, but he's got kind of a dreamy look to him. He's not really fully there, it seems. He is a scrawny little kid, and Samuel looks at him and says, that's my man. That's the man who's going to be the king of Israel. Consecrates him on the spot with a horn from a ram. Why a ram? Because this goes back to the story of Abraham and the sacrificial ram that he was supposed to give up to the Lord. And that is one of the hardest stories in the Bible to understand, because on the surface, it's an absolutely horrifying story. It's a discussion for another time, but basically, David is consecrated by the horn of a ram because he is the chosen one of the Lord. David goes forth into battle with his slingshot, kills Goliath, becomes the acclaimed king of Israel, becomes the true warrior king that everyone wants, and, you know, the people cry out in the streets, you know, Saul has killed his thousands and David has killed his tens of thousands, and so on, which leads to all the conflict. David himself, as great a king as he was still a flawed and fallible man. And that is shown later on in the Bible, where he seduces the wife of Uriah the Hittite. What's her name? Bathsheba. Like I said, I'm not a biblical scholar. No, Bathsheba, excuse me, Bathsheba. As I said, I'm not a biblical scholar. If I get stuff wrong, you know, hey, I'm totally responsible, my fault, I'm sorry. Somebody correct me if I screw stuff up. But the reason why things start going wrong for David later on in his life is because he commits this great sin of adultery, basically. He sends Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, off to get killed in battle, and then seduces his wife and so on, and does some not very nice things. And for that one sin, he is judged and he is condemned. And yet, the rest of his life is considered exemplary. I mean, despite that sin, he is considered a true exemplar of what a king should be. Because in every other respect, he basically followed the will of the Lord. If you look at his son, Solomon, Solomon was known for his hundreds and hundreds of wives and concubines, and for his enormous progeny of children. But he was also, unfortunately, known for his foolishness in allowing the worship of other gods, not the Lord. And as such, over time, he lost much of the mandate of heaven that was given to him. Despite the fact that he built the temple, the first temple, despite the fact that he was considered wise far beyond any other ruler in any other kingdom on the earth, despite the fact that he was such an exemplar of all that is good and true within Israel, despite the fact that, you know, if you look throughout the Bible, I mean, such a big chunk of it is the direct result of Solomon's work. Ecclesiastes and Proverbs and possibly, I could be wrong about this, possibly some of the, most of the Psalms, I believe, are Solomon's work. But all of that is extant because of one man, King Solomon. And yet he lost the favor of the Lord. If you look at Solomon's descendants throughout 1st and 2nd Kings, same story. Jeroboam is the one who stands out. He's one of the ones who stands out as a classic lesson in the stupidity of so-called tolerance. Gentlemen, tolerance is not a virtue. Tolerance is actually a sin. Racism is not a sin. It's not mentioned even once in the Bible as a sin. Racism, as defined in the Bible, is the love of one's own tribe over the tribes of others. This is not a sin, this is a virtue. Racism, we are taught, is the cardinal sin, it's the greatest sin of all, and we must accept everyone. No, 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 that's bullshit. Jeroboam's sin was to tolerate those of different religions and creeds and races who came into the land of Israel and established their gods and tried to worship their gods and converted Israelites to worshiping those gods, in direct contravention of the Lord's of the first and second commandments. I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. That is a terrible sin. That is, I mean, one of the worst of sins. Another king in the line, Ahab. What did he do wrong? Ahab married Jezebel and was completely ruled over by his wife. Jezebel is considered one of the most dangerous and evil spirits in all of the Bible. In all of Christianity, in all of Judaism, the Jezebel spirit is considered one of the most destructive and dangerous and lethal to the interests of men and of nations. When you have a Jezebel spirit let loose in the halls of government and within the bedchamber of, whether it's in the bedchamber of a house, or in the halls of power, no matter how it's let loose, it is incredibly destructive and incredibly dangerous. And those nations and kings who have subjected themselves to the Jezebel spirit have always regretted it. So the divine right of kings has persisted from the time of the kingdoms of Israel and Judea, however you pronounce it, all the way up to, you know, last couple of centuries. I mean, the system of monarchy did not go out of fashion until basically World War I. The divine right of kings has always been considered, for the last 2,000 years or so, the only way to govern people. The problem with this is that it puts government in the hands of one man, or in the hands of men in general. The problem with other forms of government are well known. If you look at democracy, which is a system of government that's been tried repeatedly, what is democracy? It's literally mob rule. It's just the mob ends up ruling over everything. And you always have this three-way tug of war between one man powerful enough to take command over an entire country, the aristocracy, or the nobles, or the landed classes, or the gentry, whatever you want to call them, who want to preserve their wealth and power but aren't really terribly interested in ruling over everyone else, and the mob, the lowly individuals, the farmers, the shopkeepers, the peasants, who have no power individually, but in large numbers can make or break an entire government. This is where you get Cicero's classic work, De Republica. Not the Republic, but on the public, or on government, basically, is what he was outlining. And he outlined this classic, this cycle, rock, paper, scissors cycle of governments, in which you would have a king, you know, a military ruler, a dictator, take power. And then he would be deposed eventually by aristocrats who would try to rule in his place and decentralize power away. And they, in turn, would be deposed by the mob, by the people, who would aim for a totally, you know, we are all equal mob rule situation, which would inevitably result in a king again. Because people would eventually grow tired of the chaos and the lawlessness and the injustice that would result from mob rule, and would call for a strong central leader who would take over again from the mob. This is an endless cycle, and it's one that Cicero himself predicted with uncanny accuracy for Rome, and he himself based his findings or his ideas upon things that had happened 300 years earlier, during the Peloponnesian Wars, and earlier than that even, with ancient Greece. Because the system of mob rule versus kings versus aristocracy versus mob again and so on and so forth had already been seen in Athens. That's exactly the pattern that occurred. Athens went from democracy, you know, free, well, relatively free voting, because obviously only men were allowed to vote, and only free men who owned land were allowed to vote, basically, in the Athenian assembly. They went from that to a single man as dictator and king in less than a century, and they lost their overseas empire as a result of all of that. So, mob rule doesn't work, rule of kings doesn't work, rule by nobility doesn't work. What does work? Well, if you leave it up only to the hands of men, something somewhere in between all of these three things works. Now, the examples we have of this are few and far between, very far between. You have the great retra of Sparta, given to them by Lycurgus the lawgiver. This was, you know, rumored to be, I mean, he's a semi-mythological figure. It was rumored to be back in 800 BC, so about 3,000 years old, maybe older than that. It could have been as early as 1200 BC. So for about 1,000 years, the Spartans were able to preserve their way of life, their approach to doing things. How did they do that? Well, if you look at the contents of the Great Retra, it's astonishingly accurate in its understanding of human nature. The Great Retra said that you would have two kings, not one king, but two kings. One king would remain in Sparta to oversee domestic affairs, and the other king would go out and wage war, if necessary, using the Spartan military. The two kings would be chosen from each of Sparta's two main families at the time. You know, the Great Retra was a way to try to reconcile and appease what was at the time kind of a Hatfields versus McCoys situation, where, I mean, you know, writ large, where two dominant families in Sparta were vying for total control. But then, you know, there were all these other lesser families in Sparta as well, so they wanted power too. So Lycurgus basically said, all right, you're also going to have a council of sort of peers or judges, ephors. The ephors are not able to pass any laws by themselves. The kings have to propose the laws, the kings have to enforce the laws, and they have to propose laws. But the ephors have the right to reject any laws that the kings or the mass assembly, I forget exactly what it was called, can propose. Which brings us to the next piece of the puzzle, which is the Spartan homoioi, or peers. The Spartan citizens, all of whom were full-fledged members of Spartan society who had a vote because they had completed military service. They had gone through the agoge. They had served in the Spartan military from the age of 22 to the age of 32, and then became part of the Spartan reserve. Those men were free and clear Spartan citizens, and their numbers ranged from anywhere from 10,000 to 25,000 at a time. This was a proto-communist society. All of them were identical in terms of rights. They were equal. All land was owned by the state. They were given portions of land by the state government, but they didn't work any of it. The free men of Sparta did not work the land. They had slaves for that, helots. Like all communist societies, Sparta was a slave state. You know, all communist societies end up this way. They all end up as slave states. But the voice of the people was through another special assembly, which could propose laws but could not reject anything that the kings said. You know, the Spartan assembly was a counterbalance to the power of the ephors and the kings. And just in case any one branch started to get too powerful, the Spartan state also had the Crypteia, the secret police, which was a like a special spec ops division of the Spartan military, where the best and strongest and toughest and most experienced soldiers would go in to the Crypteia and effectively serve as assassins for the state. They would go around, you know, killing off anybody who was a direct security threat to the Spartan state, but they also had the mandate to kill the kings of Sparta if they got a little bit too uppity, too big for their britches. That is the extent to which Lycurgus the Lawgiver understood the nature of humans and the need to balance out different competing interest groups. And it worked. It worked really well, except for that little problem of the fact that Spartan society was based on slaves. To the point where, you know, Spartans' citizens were outnumbered anywhere between 7 to 15 to 1 at any given point in time by the Helots. I mean, if Spartans were, you know, 10,000 to 20,000, 25,000, the Helots were anywhere from 75,000 to 300,000 slaves. And the Spartans would routinely go around killing and murdering slaves as part of their annual, you know, agoge trials. That there was actually a specific day or night, 24-hour period, in which Spartan boys were encouraged to go out there and brutalize the slaves without getting caught. So, you know, it was like the purge, basically, writ large. The Spartans were a very, very strange people, very exotic customs. But that was how they operated, and they did well with that system. They became the dominant power in all of Greece for a couple of hundred years. And they got to the point where, even though they were a land-based power, they were able to take it to the Athenians and beat them at sea with, by the way, a lot of Persian help. If you haven't read a book called The Western Way of War by Victor Davis Hanson, well worth reading. And if you want to read about the Peloponnesian War specifically and the radical differences between Spartan and Athenian culture and how Sparta eventually won that war, then read A War Like No Other by the same author. Tremendous book. Very much worth reading. The other example of republican rule before we come to the modern day was, of course, Rome. Now, the city fathers of Rome had a very different situation. They had a bunch of tribes as well, the seven hills and seven tribes of Rome, which they had to glue together into a working framework, but they also had a deep and abiding distrust and hatred of god kings, because the Romans had experience with god kings in the past, and they firmly, the ruling families of Rome firmly rejected the idea of ever allowing kings to rule over the Roman population. So they created a system in which the Senate had all of the power. And the Senate was composed of noble families. But there were counterweights to the Senate. Not very strong ones, but there were counterweights. And that system of republican rule lasted a good, 700-800 years? Something like that? In which the Roman Republic eventually became the Roman Empire and was replaced. You know, the power of the Senate was replaced by the power of the Emperor. But that cycle of civilizations that Cicero predicted carried on regardless. All of those lessons were eventually absorbed into the modern-day framework we have of either parliamentary monarchies or parliamentary democracies or republics. Now, democracy is the god that failed, and that's why I came up with the title of this video, this podcast. Democracy, the God That Failed is a book by the Austro-Libertarian kind of anarcho-capitalist, actually, Professor Hans Hermann Hoppe. I've only read about 20% or so of that book before I got bored and moved on to other things, but the case that he lays out is that democracy is an utter and total failure. If you look at the first 20% of that book, in which he points out how much better things were under kings, he's absolutely right. In the late 19th century, if you look at all of the nations of Europe, that was probably the high point of European civilization right there. They didn't have the creature comforts that we have now. But if you look at the art and the culture that came out of Europe at the time, it was easily the most advanced civilization that had ever been seen on the European continent. Interest rates were low. It was about 2%, you know, give or take. The average interest rate throughout most of the continent was about 2%. Inflation was basically non-existent because all of the currencies were gold-backed. Taxes were extremely low. The average tax burden was between 7 and 10%, which is unheard of these days in our era of social welfare states. The abuses heaped upon the people by the kings and the parliaments of the time were as nothing compared to what they are today under democracy. The rule of kings was, on balance, a good thing for the people of Europe. Now, why is that? Because, ultimately, the rule of a king is reflective of the relationship between God and man. And that sounds kind of weird based on, you know, if you look back at what I said earlier in this podcast about what God said to the people of Israel when they said, we want a king. He said, you're going to regret it. They said, we don't care. But in a true Christian society, who is sovereign? God is sovereign. So, given that democracy has failed, and given that republicanism has failed, utterly and totally, because that's what you're looking at right now. You're looking at the destruction of the United States, which is the exemplar of republican government. The U.S. isn't a republic anymore and has not been for a very long time. The U.S. used to have a clear system of checks and balances where every level of government was pitted against every other level to ensure that the maximal freedom of the people was preserved. That's been thrown out the window. And it's been out the window for 100 years. Ever since the rise of the progressive movement, the idea of checks and balances on government has been totally trashed and destroyed. Doesn't matter where you look, there is no check, there is no balance on government power. Conservatives love to talk about how the Supreme Court or the courts in general will save the Republic. Guys, that's ridiculous. There is no rule of law in the USA. The law is not what is written on the books. The law is what a judge says it is. And that has been made abundantly clear by the Supreme Court of the United States on multiple occasions. There is no right to abortion in the Constitution. There is no such thing. And yet, a judge wrote a frankly ridiculous opinion in Roe v. Wade, stating that there are emanations and penumbras coming from the Constitution, which he tortured into some, Justice Harry Blackmun did this, tortured into some kind of weird right to privacy, which, by the way, doesn't exist in the Constitution either. So he invented a right to privacy, and then invented from that an interpretation that says that a woman has a right to privacy of her body, and therefore there is a right to abortion. The logic is so stupid and absurd that Justice Blackmun himself contradicted his own majority opinion in a finding just a few weeks later in a different court case. If you look at what Justice Gorsuch did in authoring, I mean, supposedly the great savior of the conservative movement, Justice Gorsuch authored the majority opinion in a recent case about LGBTQ, what the fuck is this shit, rights, recently, in which he basically said the alphabet soup people are protected by Title IX of the federal code against discrimination. Now, this has just opened up Pandora's box, because now it means that any LGBTQ WTF is this nonsense people can sue their employers for discrimination at any point in time. No matter what, they can sue them. It's like, what the hell? I mean, why would you do that? Why would you open up that can of worms? Once again, he invented a right. So there is no rule of law in the USA anymore. What, then, does a successful system of government look like? A successful system of government has to have a mandate from heaven. We've seen that. There are successful systems of government which have worked in the past, whether they are monarchy or a combination of monarchy and constitutional parliament or a constitutional republic or a balancing act between a kind of a king figure, a house of nobility figure, the judges, the masses, such as the USA used to have. Ultimately, a successful system of government depends on putting God in place as sovereign. When God is sovereign, and God rules over all else, whether it's through Jesus Christ, his Son, and our King and Lord, or directly, as he used to do, you know, through speaking through judges for his verdicts, the ultimate result is a much more harmonious and much more just society. I'll give you an example. In the Bible, it says that rape is punishable by death. Okay? That's true. It is. It also says that adultery is punishable by death. Yeah. These are far harsher penalties than we have today. Here's the thing, though. The Bible also makes it very clear that there have to be witnesses to these events. There have to be two witnesses to adultery. And those witnesses must corroborate each other's accounts. And there have to be other witnesses to back up those accounts in order for justice to prevail. So if a woman is adulterous and she is caught being adulterous by at least two people who say, yeah, she did that and I saw her, and they are credible witnesses, then yeah, she dies. But so does the man, right? This is a much more just system than most people realize. Pedophiles are put to death immediately. I mean, who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want a situation, a justice system, in which someone who molests a child, someone who brings grievous psychological and physical torment to a child, is not executed? I would love a system like that. I would love to live in a world where pedophiles are treated without mercy, swiftly given justice and held accountable for their crimes. Rapists, same thing. Abortion would be treated as murder, because it is murder. In every way, a system of government which treats God as sovereign would be a much more just and much more harmonious system, because it is God's law that rules, not the laws of men. God's law is given to us not just in, you know, the Pentateuch, but also in the New Testament. And the New Testament, as far as Christians are concerned, completely supplants the Old. The Old Testament provides the foundation, but the New Testament is the finishing of that foundation. So that is where, you know, all of the kind of almost anal retentive laws of the Old Testament are done away with, all the unnecessary filler and fluff designed to make obedience to ritual rather than obedience to the law like the cornerstone of daily life, all of that is removed. Now what matters is obedience to the will of God. And once you start doing that, once you start seeing things that way, a lot of the craziness and stupidity that we see around us, a lot of the corruption, a lot of the malfeasance, a lot of the evil that we see around us will just vanish very quickly, because there isn't any more room for that. There isn't room for debt-based slavery, because there would be a debt jubilee every 50 years or so. There isn't room for hyperinflation, because currencies would be backed by silver and gold. There isn't room for malfeasance and corruption of the kind that we constantly get with respect to priests and churches, because the churches themselves would be held accountable to God. There isn't any room for judges making up their own laws, because those laws are not the laws of men, they're the laws of God. You can't reinterpret and, you know, lawyer your way out of that stuff. I mean, Judaism has been trying to, or I should say modern Judaism has been trying to do that for a very long time, to lawyer its way out of the statutes that God laid down in through the Ten Commandments and so on. All you would need, in fact, and I've outlined this on the blog before, is the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. That's all you need for a moral and just society. Well, you know, what do those Ten Commandments say? I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not carry the name of the Lord in vain. You shall not worship, make unto yourself a graven image of anything on this earth or in the sea or in the air to worship. You shall honor your mother and father. You shall hold to the Sabbath, the day of rest, and keep it holy. You shall not murder. It's not you shall not kill, it's you shall not murder. You shall not adulter. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet, right? These 10 things are all mutually self-reinforcing constructs. They're a perfect moral law unto themselves. You cannot take away one without causing the rest of it to collapse. The single most important commandment of all of these, probably, is thou shalt not steal. Because that is the central theme under which all of the other commandments fall, pretty much. To give you another example, if you were to take the commandment about the Sabbath, that seems very arbitrary, but actually it's a brilliant idea. It basically says, for one day out of every seven, you will rest, and everyone around you will rest. You will just take some time off to contemplate your place in the universe, to worship the Lord, and to be with your family, and to be with your loved ones. It doesn't say don't do any work. I mean, that's taking it like to complete extremes, where you sit like a bump on a log and don't do anything. No, that's not what it says. You take some time to contemplate the good things in life, to be grateful to God for all that you are given, to spend time with your family and your friends. This is great. This is good. Breaking the Sabbath is not a sin under Christianity anymore. And Jesus healed people on the Sabbath. He fed people on the Sabbath. It's not against the dictates of conscience. But it is a chance for people to take a step back and enjoy the fruits of life. I mean, that's a very profound and enlightened way of looking at the world. You will honor your mother and father. He's another great example. What better way can you think of to bring families closer than to give honor to the people who brought you into this world? You don't have to have a great relationship with them necessarily, but you honor them. You give them thanks. You give them respect for all they've done for you. Maybe it wasn't all that much. Some people have great parents. Some people have terrible ones. I'm lucky. I have great parents. I'm incredibly lucky. So I honor them by trying to carry on their ideas and their words and their philosophies through my own life. Not, I admit, very successfully, it must be said. But, it is what it is. In closing, the way to have a successful system of government is not to leave it up to men. We've tried that for several thousand years, and it's always failed. Ultimately, it always fails because the God that failed is the God that we created for ourselves, the God of self-worship, the God of self-love, the God that says, you shall be as gods. That was a colossal mistake, and we are paying for that mistake every single day in every possible way, and we will continue to pay for that mistake until the kingdom of heaven descends upon us. We will never stop paying for that mistake because of the original sin. But the way we try to get closer to redeeming ourselves for that mistake is by putting God front and center and saying, what does he want us to do? What does he want us to focus our lives upon? What is his law? What are his priorities? So that's everything I have for today. We're coming up on the 1 hour mark. Many thanks for listening in. I do have an announcement to make, which is that my first business commercial type website is up. It's called superbshaving.com, and there's not a whole lot to it just yet, but there will be over time. It's a niche website all about wet shaving and masculine grooming, and there are Amazon affiliate links and products buried throughout the pages. It is definitely going to be the first of several sites to come. So if you like my work, you like what I do, you want to support me, and I certainly hope you do after all the content that I've been putting out there for years and years now, head over to superbshaving.com, click on some of the affiliate links, buy some stuff from Amazon. Even if you don't buy what I'm advertising, you buy something through Amazon, I will get some of the money back as a commission through the affiliate process. So Please make sure you do that if you like what you're hearing. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 35, The God That Failed.